part of the work that Bill and I are doing is just to help parents and teachers and kids feel that it's safe not to worry about their kids all the time. And I'm not opposed to kids getting A's, but if the only thing they have after 4 years of high school, you know, or 12 years of education is a pile of A's, oh, geez.
Welcome to Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I'm your host and chief goddess of the PASS Foundation, Annalise Corbin. We know the current model for education is obsolete. It was designed to create fleets of assembly line workers, not the thinkers and problem solvers needed today. We've seen the innovations that are possible within education, and it's our goal to leave the box behind and reimagine what education can look like in your own backyard. Welcome to Learning Unboxed. As always, I am excited to talk with another great innovator in the transformative education space. And today we are going to be talking about control and autonomy, two topics that are pretty near and dear and wickedly important these days. And joining us today for this conversation is Ned Johnson, co-author of The Self-Driven Child and What Do You Say? So Ned, welcome to Learning Unboxed.
Well, thank you for having me. I look forward to digging into this with you.
Absolutely. I'm super excited to have you. It's been a while since I've seen you, and it's always fun to have the conversation. But let's set a bit of context, if we could, for our listeners as we get started. The Self-Driven Child and What Do You Say are about the importance of a sense of control for mental health and internal motivation, and on the problems associated with parental over-control. A low sense of control is the most stressful thing that we can experience, and an absence of agency contributes strongly to all the stress-related mental health problems affecting young people, including anxiety disorders, depression, eating and substance use disorders, and self-harm, and I suspect so many other things. So, Ned, let's start with, when you think about this idea of sense of control from two dimensions, help us understand, what does that all mean, and why does that matter in sort of today's world?
Sure. So the two domains we think of this in, the two directions, are one, the subjective sense of autonomy, maybe agency, competency, you know, that I'm not a pawn in other people's plans, right? I have a say over my life. I get choices. I get to, you know, handle things when they go poorly. I don't just have everything decided for me or done for me. And second domain is the brain state that supports a healthy sense of control, meaning that when we're in our right minds, the prefrontal cortex, the most recently involved part of the brain, kind of runs the show. You know, those executive functions are online. It dampens down the stress response. So when something tough or intense happens, we don't sort of freeze or go, you know, kind of freak out. The problem-solving parts of our brain engage, and we think, well, what are my options here? How can I handle this? And these things really work together, that without the brain state of a healthy sense of control, you're not going to feel autonomy, right? You're not going to feel a sense of control. You're going to feel helpless or hopeless or powerless or overwhelmed or resigned to leading a life that you don't like, right? But it's both the experiences lead to this brain development, And healthy brain development leads to the sense of control. So both of these things are important. And from what we can see, well, if you follow the work of Jean Twenge and the MM and her generations, every year, the sense of control that kids feel about their own lives and the world they live in just gets lower and lower and lower. So it shouldn't be really a surprise to anyone that the mental health disorders keep getting worse and worse and worse. And so from our angle on this, one of the ways to address so many of these issues, in addition to Jonathan Haidt's work, when we can talk about that if you want, is really to give kids more opportunities to feel like they're in charge of their own life and be able to develop the brain circuits that allow them to handle adversity, because there's not going to be any child or any person who ever lives a life without challenge. And we want to develop brains to be able to handle challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that when we give kids control or we allow for a greater sense of agency, all kinds of really remarkable things start to happen in their lives, in the way that they're developing and the choices they're making and the way that they're interacting and reacting with the world. So I'm curious, as you sort of think about this, and it's interesting to me about you, because one of the other things that we haven't really mentioned is that you were involved in the sort of thinking about the way folks learn from a variety of different spaces. So, you know, you're an epic tutor of folks trying to live in a standardized world, but at the same time, you're writing about and thinking about living in a less controlled or constrained world in many, many ways. And so, you know, when you think about the play of these two things, how do you reconcile that as it relates to what you're advocating for here?
I'll tell you a little bit of a story of a recent kid I'm working with. She came to me, I guess the end of sophomore year, when a lot of kids start up test prep. And her dad was talking about how she might get extra time based on an eye tracking issue. And what I know about that suggests that it's probably something else going on. And so I sat down with dad and this kid. And the more I sat with them, the more I thought, boy, there's a lot under the surface here, and gently made them feel that it was safe to go off and do a neuropsychological evaluation. Actually, the Stickshire group, my writing partner, William Stickshire, is a clinical neuropsychologist, and so went over there, and the report came back, unsurprising to me, undiagnosed ADHD, unsurprising to me, undiagnosed anxiety, unsurprising to me, undiagnosed depression, surprising to me, undiagnosed dyslexia. And I thought, holy smokes, how do you get this deep into this process? Long, complicated story, family stuff, the details of which don't really matter. But somewhere along the line, things weren't going well in her world. And I gently asked her, I said, who do you feel closest to in the world? And I said, I'm sure your friends are great. And she said, well, there's you. And I thought, I'm grateful to be part of that inner sanctum, but we probably need a deeper bench. And I asked her at that point, I said, remind me, what do you think the most important outcome of high school and adolescence is? And she said, well, obviously getting good grades and getting into a good college. And I said, what? And I said, gently, if I may, we've talked about this. I said, you're a really cool kid. You're bright. Thanks, mom and dad, for the genes. But you're also ADHD, and you're anxious, and you're depressed. And the way that I see this is that the most important outcome of high school and adolescence is really developing the brain that you carry into college if you go into adulthood. You know, and the good news is anxiety is super treatable, right? And ADHD will get your executive functions to develop. And I said, in some ways, I could give a fig about your ACT score. And she said, you shouldn't say that. And I said, I shouldn't say what? That you don't care about my ACT scores. I said, well, here's the great thing. I said, anything that helps you or supports your happiness and healthy brain development, getting more sleep, being happier, more time with friends, expanding your world beyond just grades and tests, all of these things, it's great for your brain development. It's also good for test scores. I can't lose, right? And so I'm probably a little unconventional in the ways that I approach test prep. Spent a lot of time, no offense to College Board or ACT, kind of trashing these organizations, the role of these tests and these tests themselves, in part because the more stressed out kids get, the less well they think. And I am hell-bent on helping kids feel more safe in the world, that there's a plan B for pretty much anything. And curiously, that also has the added benefit of helping them do better on scores. So parents often don't have any idea what I'm doing. They just know that I'm pretty good at helping kids do well on these silly little tests.
Yeah. But this is a real reality, right? We live in a society that is hyper-focused in many ways, although we are starting to see some shifts, thank goodness. But we still put a tremendous amount of time, energy, and resources around this sort of myth, I guess, if you will, that this is the thing that everybody has to do and has to do well. And I'm sure that you bump up against all the time. And it's one of the reasons why you and your writing partner wrote The Self-Driven Child and What Do You Say? In the sense that how do we get the families to stop being part of the root cause? I mean, the fact that any kid would say to you, and I know I experience this all the time as well, right? I hear this all the time. What's the most important thing? Oh my gosh, you know, I've got to get into a good college. I've got to get all A's. You know, I've got to maintain that 4.0. And it's one of the saddest things I hear from kids.
Yeah, I mean, there are two thoughts on that. One is I'm in the middle of trying to sort of wrestle to the ground an article or a blog, I'm not sure where it'll end up, with the current working title of, but they're getting A's, but they're getting A's. And partly the grade inflation, and everyone has kind of an interest in kids getting A's, from colleges to administrators to teachers who they don't want blowback to parents and kids. I get it, sort of. But it becomes a colossal rug under which we can sweep all manner of challenges, right? The kid is clinically anxious, but she's getting A's. He's depressed, but he's getting A's, right? I have a colleague who has three kids, triplets, one of whom, he's autistic with a lot of cognitive challenges. She said he gets A's in everything. He reads at a third grade level. And okay, I mean, fortunately, he's in getting the right education. He's in a great place to get the kind of support that he needs. But we create all kinds of problems. I have a kid I'm working with for the SSCT. It's a standardized test to get into. She's at an independent school, and she's trying to go to private high school as well. And so it has three sections, one of which is verbal. The way the test works is you get a point for every question you get right. You lose a quarter of a point for every question you get wrong, with the idea that guessing doesn't give you an advantage. Okay, fine. She got a score of 0, which means that she answered less than 20% of the questions right, more than 80% wrong. These are not things you typically see from a child in an educated, successful, supportive, loving, affluent family. Like, this is, to use a Bill Stickshirtism, my writing partner, unexpected. And so I start poking around, because she lives in a verbally rich world, so it's odd that words aren't in her head. And I ask her mom about this. Well, it's interesting. You should ask that. And she goes back to the teachers, said, well, yeah, I noticed that, but I guess I should have said something. I'm like, I'm waiting for the testing to come back, but the idea that she doesn't have dyslexia or something related, I will be flabbergasted. And I'll go all the way back to Alfred Binet, he of the Stanford Binet IQ test before, when he was a French educator, designed his test not to make a linear ranking of children, but to identify kids who needed more help. And in a perfect world, that's what grades do, and that's what scores do, when we use them to go, huh, well, that seems odd. Let's put some energy into that to figure out whether there's something that needs more attention. So that's my take on tests generally. With parents, I think part of it is helping them feel that it's safe not to worry all the time. One of the researchers we love most is a woman named Sonia Lupien, who heads the Center for Studies of Human Stress up in Montreal. And she says you can summarize what makes people anxious with the acronym of NUTS, what makes them nuts, right? So N is novelty, U, unpredictability, T is perceived threat. And for kids and often their loving parents, that's threat to ego. And then S is a low sense control. And the low sense control is the worst thing you can experience. She then comes around with arguably the single most helpful cognitive tool to lower stress is just to have plan B thinking. Because basically every kid in the country could go to college if he or she wants to.
Right.
There's a college for everyone. And so what are there, 50 colleges that have admissions rate under 20% total? But the way you'd act like you'd think it's like the Hunger Games. It's only space for two children. Like, and it creates so much unneeded, unnecessary stress around this whole system. And so kids can't, I'm just over my shoulder, there's a book called The Disengaged Teen. If you know these folks, Rebecca Winthrop, who heads the Center for Global Education at Brookings, and her colleague Jenny Anderson, who's a longtime journalist. And they have this big piece that just came out about student disengagement, where 70% of parents of high school kids think that their kids aren't engaged in school. 30% of teens, in part because so many kids feel like they're doing work that's not meaningful. They're being asked to do things that have no connection to anything. And they feel super low agency. And we do have high achievers, but the high achievers are often just driven by fear. And it's such a terrible spend of teen brain development, and certainly our tax dollars and tuition dollars, to have kids just be doing school.
For the sake of doing school.
Yeah, so well said, for the sake of doing school. And so part of the work that Bill and I are doing is just to help parents and teachers and kids feel that it's safe not to worry about their kids all the time. And I'm not opposed to getting A's, but if the only thing they have after 4 years of high school, you know, or 12 years of education is a pile of A's, oh, geez.
Are you ready to join the movement to revolutionize education? Stay tuned for the full unveiling of my forthcoming book, Hacking School, 5 Strategies to Link Learning to Life, where we'll dive deeper into these topics and unlock key strategies to educational transformation. If you want to stay in the know, sign up for notifications at pastfoundation.org/hacking school.
And then we send them off to post-secondary because those poor kids believe that's the only place they have to go next, right? Because that's where the pressure is sending all of our many of these kids. Again, that is starting to change and we love that. But then those kids get into post-secondary and they wander around. And on the some levels, there's nothing wrong with that. Try lots of things, right? We want you to find the thing that gets you all jazzed. And hopefully that's the thing if you're yeah, there.
Let's to meander, but not wander maybe.
Yeah, meander, right. But I think part of the problem is that the 12 years prior to, we've not allowed kids to explore and to find the relevancy in the things that they're learning to who they are in that moment and who they aspire to be moving forward. And that's part of, in my opinion, my Annalise's theory here, right? Annalise's theory is that if we would let kids spend that time meaningfully, right? Yep. And artfully, yep. I think, as I'm not just calling, you know, for a willy-willy sort of approach here, but that we allow these kiddos to have just crazy experiences and opportunities and to figure out what they love and what they don't love. And more importantly, I think they will magically excel on the standardized tests that we use to measure X, Y, and Z because they will have such a robust experience in which to gauge that against.
100%. Do you know Stuart Slavin? Have you met Stuart yet?
I haven't met Stuart, but okay. I know who Stuart is. Yes.
Yeah, so I'll share with your listeners a couple of folks. So Stuart is a pediatrician and a medical educator, and he was at the time teaching at St. Louis University. And we think mental health challenges are challenging for kids in high school. They're worse in young adults, and they are off the charts for kids in medical university. I mean, it's terrible. So he was exploring this and deeply concerned, and they made some changes. They decreased the amount of instruction and instructional time by 20%. They gave them every Friday or half a Friday, something like this, where basically they could spend the day doing independent study, going deep on whatever they wanted, whatever they cared about. And they gave them a few hours of training on kind of cognitive reframing to talk back against imposter syndrome and all this kind of stuff. It decreased the amount of depression by 80%.
Wow.
And the test scores went up because they have all these board scores, right? For in part because anxious and depressed brains don't do very well with anything, including standardized tests.
Right.
I just met, and I'll have to, you know, if you may want to talk with this, a fantastic educator. She's a school counselor named Amy Buckman. Our mutual friend Mike Nicholson connected me, and they have a learning inspired grant, 3 years of studying. It's a student agency. How do we do this? And they've introduced what do they call them? Flex Fridays. And they get to spend half the day doing just what you're describing, basically anything they want, so long as they have a plan, they have parental buy-in, and they have, you know, some connection with a faculty advisor. Like, okay, what are objectives? What are you trying to do? And a huge percent of the kids are doing, like, you know, CTE, you know, career and technical education. Like, I want to learn to weld. I want to do car repair. Da, da, da. And they get to go deep. Now, here's the only condition for this is they have to come to school. They can't just show up only on Friday. They have to come to school. Mm-hmm. And she said the attendance, we talked about, you know, school attendance has just been a disaster since COVID. It has absolutely flipped the script because here's a crazy idea. Kids are actually now coming to school because they, wait for it, have a reason to want to go to school.
Right.
And these are, and she said the great part is these are not kids. A lot of these kids aren't, you know, all APs, Harvard bound, whatever. But they are coming to school and they are engaging with their school because they have something in school that feels engaging. And, you know, there's so many ways that now they can tie in, I don't know, math or something because they want to open their own shop. You can paint a lot of different pictures of how these tools that they're learning in other classes do apply. But the secret sauce is, just as you said, for them to explore and figure out what matters to them. There's a story in our second book, What Do You Say?, where I was talking with a girl and his parents were, gosh, they were not parents of the year in my view. And we've started, it's our senior year, it's our last crack of these silly tests. And I asked her, I said, out of curiosity, I said, what do you most like to do in the world? And she said, honestly, I have no idea.
Oh.
I spend all my energy hopping through other people's hoops. I really don't know. And I said, well, you might want to explore that a little bit. Well, what she'd shared with me, but she didn't really realize it, was that her school has basically a fashion show where it's an all-girls school where they design clothes, they make the clothes, which is super complicated. I had no idea. And then they have a runway show. So she told me about this. So I sneak over there. She's towards the end of the show. And her friends are all, and it's great stuff. I mean, I'm not very fashionable, as you can tell, but I'm like, this is cool, right? And when her lineup or whatever is finally comes up, oh, and I snuck in a little bit late because I had something else I was doing, and I ended up seated directly behind her mom. Mm-hmm. And when this girl's lineup, their friends are finally walking her stuff, her mom has her head in her phone, not taking pictures, looking at whatever. And it could not have been more clear a message of what you're doing, what matters to you, doesn't matter to me. And I thought, well, there you go.
Painful.
And to her everlasting credit, she got into my friend Akil Bello says, the highly rejective college, not highly selective, highly rejective. She got in there and after a year transferred to Parsons, one of the top fashion schools in the country. And I say, good on you for finally... Mm-hmm. Helping your parents feel safe and having the courage to say, this is not the life I want to live. That's the life I want to lead.
Yeah. But,
we could start it earlier.
Well, exactly. That's what I was going to say. I mean, what the painful part of all of that is, for this young person to get to their senior year in high school and have no idea what you like. Like not a hobby, not an aspiration, not if I could spend my time doing anything, this is what it would be. And I think we see that a lot in kids, right? Especially our high-flying kids who honestly, right? One of the things that I always tell families, especially those kids that struggle when we move them into a fully applied hands-on environment, mm-hmm. A lot of those kids, they're the ones that are going to struggle the most, right? Because, what am I supposed to memorize? What am I supposed to be studying? It's Tuesday and it's 2:22. I'm supposed to be learning something very specific right in this moment, right? Those kids struggle the most. But what I often will tell those families is you need to be patient, right? Because yes, those kids are going to struggle the most here. But the reality is, that kid will probably figure out how to do well in most of the environments that you opt to put them in if we reduce the stress of saying that you have to have it figured out right from the get-go.
Well, it's 100%, and the thing that I hope parents can wrap their heads around is that when we think about lives, what we really want is for kids to be able to identify meaningful goals and then make plans and pursue those goals. And they're teenagers, so they're allowed to keep the grown-ups guessing by changing their plans and their goals every darn week like they change their fashion. They're allowed to do that. But when kids are figuring out what they want to do, they're making choices about their own life, they're dealing with things that are challenging and solving problems. It doesn't matter whether you're trying to straighten out a social entanglement or figure out how to make a carburetor, get unclogged and work again, or figure out how to put words on paper and express your ideas cogently in an essay. All of those involve the same neural circuits of the prefrontal cortex, and you're developing those executive functions. And so a lot of times people worry, though, my kid has no academic interest. As Bill would say, and again, Bill's a clinical neuropsychologist, so he spends all of his time working with kids where learning is hard, emotions are hard, self-regulation is hard, blah, 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 blah. And he says, so long as a kid is working harder and harder to get better and better at something that matters to them, I don't worry about them. I don't worry about them because they're developing intrinsic motivation. They're developing stress tolerance. Golly, I never get more like throwing around four-letter words than when I'm trying to fix I have this John Deere tractor. It's a long story. I'm just competent enough to think that I can fix things, but clearly too incompetent to legit. I mean, if it's more than three moving parts, I'm in trouble, right? But for any kid who's deeply engaged in that way, they're going to be fine because they're developing their brains. The ones that we worry about, and back to Rebecca and Jenny's book, are kids who are passengers, right? Who are just kind of coast along, and they're not really actively engaged in any part of the life. And brains develop in the ways that they're used.
Right.
All right. You know, there's a great researcher named Reed Larson who in the 90s was looking at how is it that teens become intrinsically motivated. And he said it was not by dutifully doing their homework, doing school, as you know, but what he described is the passionate pursuit of pastimes. So whether that's music or sports or design or rock climbing or, you know, coding, I mean, if baking, anything where kids are deeply engaged, it's a brain that's developing. It's really sculpting an adult brain. And so it would help a lot if all of us as educators and parents and kids themselves to feel just safe that there isn't this one very narrow path to life, to success in life. It's just not so.
Mm-hmm. It's not. And I think the other thing that as adults, either we don't know or we forget, right, is that when we think about the way kids develop, you know, they hit their tweens, right? Those preteen years, that sort of middle school space. I love middle school. And I love middle school kids. And lots of people don't. And I totally understand it. Even having had my own kids at that age, it can be tough. But the other thing that I think that people forget is, you know, outside of that infancy space, it's the greatest brain development, physiological development happening in our human lifetime.
Right.
So we push back, and it's the very time that these kids need that sense of control so much and the autonomy because of what's going on with them. And it's also the time where we tend to start ratcheting down on these kids to get ready for high school and on all these other things that we attribute to them. And we have the actual opposite impact that we're trying to have because of the way we think about that space.
Right. 100%. It was funny. I saw a social media post by someone I actually like quite a bit, and she had all the things that are in kids' heads. And this might have been like, I don't know, freshman year, so slightly older. But she's like, you know, math, English, da-da-da, college, you know, vocabulary, whatever, whatever. And I'm thinking, oh, no. Who are my friends? Do my friends really like me?
Yeah.
You know, who am I trying to be? How do I present myself to the world? How do I present myself on social media? You know, I mean, all of these things that the real work of adolescence, it seems to me, is trying to figure out who am I? Who do I want to be in this world? How do I want to contribute, you know, socially, you know? And I mean, because we think it's all about academics, but how do I show up and contribute to all the spaces where I am? And these are really complicated things. I remember a parents came to me and they were griping about their daughter who's driving them nuts. And they said, she questions everything that we tell her. And I'm like, high five. And they're like, what? And I said, this is fantastic. Because don't you want a kid who says, well, Annalise says I should do such and such, and go, is that really true? And then thinks about it and thinks about it and thinks about it and think, and either comes up with their own way of thinking about life or goes, she might have a point there.
Yeah.
Right. At which point it becomes their own, right? Who wants to raise a child who just reflexively agrees with everything that anyone in a position of authority over them tells them to do? Oh, no. These are not good citizens.
They're not going to grow up to be people that are going to question the world and then figure out how to make a contribution, right? And at the end of the day, and that's the other conversation I often will have, is like, okay, what are we preparing kids for? I would argue that what we're preparing kids for is to grow up to be fully functional adults who are making a contribution in the world.
Yep.
And how that works for that particular individual, what it looks like, what it is that they do, right? You know, that's not up to us. And the fact that we spend any time trying to make it up to us is us spinning our own wheels, right?
I mean, it's so true. I mean, we have a chapter in The Self-Driven Child called Kids as Decision Makers. And the phrase that we suggest is, it's your call. It's your call. Because we so often, anytime, from our perspective, in addition to telling a kid, like, you know, I love you from the top of your head to the bottom of your toes, to tell them, particularly for a teenager, I have real confidence in your ability to make decisions about your life. I do. Because you got a brain in your head and you want your life to work out. And when you make mistakes, which you will, you're going to figure out what the next, you know, plan B there is. And we often think that decisions are really rooted in cognition. It has to be, these are totally rational, you know, column A, column B, you know, Excel spreadsheet, the thing, decisions. But that's really not how decisions work. The guy, Antonio Damasio, who studies decision-making, and he said, if you have someone who has brain injury to the emotional part of the brain, they can't figure out what they want for breakfast.
Right.
Because what it starts with, back to my child who, you know, loves fashion, it starts with, what do I want? Who do I want to be? Who do I want to date? How do I want to contribute to the world, right? And it's this complicated balance of present and future and me and others. And it's really complex calculus. And we want kids to struggle with those, again, developing that the prefrontal cortex the whole while. And then we want them to own that decision. Because when we make decisions for kids, in some ways, if they feel like it's been shoved down their throat, they can be invested in their own failure just to be, I told you it wouldn't work, right? And I see this all the time.
Yeah.
I have a daughter who, we talked about her when we met over out west, who's brilliant, 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 at age 19 diagnosed with autism. Who knew? Not her, not the neuropsychologist, nobody knew. Mm-hmm. And so she has a certain hat. She's getting much more flexible because that's another cognitive function that develops, was just impossibly rigid. And I could drive her nuts and she could reciprocate. And I figured out pretty early on, I was never, never, never going to win an argument with Katie Johnson. One, she wasn't going to give an inch. And two, I didn't have the brain power to pull that off. And so I just say, look, you know, this has to be it's your call. What do you want to do? And when you'd say it's your call, this should be your decision because this is your life. But I'd like to run by my perspective on it. Is it okay if I share that? When we take force off the table, and because a low sense of control is so stressful, it brings down that defensiveness. The amygdala is not spun up, and we get to engage with kids or anyone prefrontal cortex to prefrontal cortex, and makes it much more likely that they're open to our thoughts and suggestions. And last thing, of course, is that we often think, well, the prefrontal cortex aren't fully developed. Teens especially can make decisions that are just as good, 100% just as good as adults can make. What they lack is information, though TikTok helps, and more importantly, they lack perspective. So we want kids to talk to people who are older, who just have other experiences, mm-hmm. and we're much more likely to help kids be open to that. If again, you know, it's your call, but I'd like you to talk to Annalise because I know she knows something about it.
Yeah.
I've never seen it not work when I've worked with it, when I've used this, even with other people's teens. So,
absolutely, absolutely. And experience is everything, right? And so giving kids experiences everywhere we possibly can, right? And experiences that appeal to them, not the experiences that we feel like they should be doing.
So well said.
So, so powerful. So powerful. Ned, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to chat with us and to share the work that you're doing and to really sort of level back up, I guess, if you will, the conversation around giving students autonomy, agency, control. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you for that. Well, like you, I find teens endlessly fascinating. Mm-hmm. And when we treat them respectfully, they're so much more likely to let us in on the remarkably cool things that are going on in their heads. And it's just a hoot. And like you, I remind people that teens, they have brains in their heads, mm-hmm. and they want their lives to work out, as do we.
They absolutely do. And I agree, because they're awesome. So yeah, embrace the inner middle school or teenage child. Absolutely, 100%. Thank you again so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Annalise.
Thank you for joining us for Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I want to thank my guests and encourage you all to be part of the conversation. Meet me on social media at Annalise Corbin, and join me next time as we stand up, step back, and lean in to reimagine education.